Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program devoted to the largest segment of society, to those who are coming to realize that all of the world's religious, political, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they're all counterproductive and not one of them can be fixed, and that there is hope for those who are willing to learn, who are willing to keep an open mind, and who are still capable of executing good judgment. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this dialogue anytime over the next 3 hours, is 877-376-45. It is interesting to note that among the initial seven bodies that were recovered from the sea, almost all of them still fully clothed, at the crash of the Airbus A320 flown by Air Asia, the realization that one of them was wearing a life jacket, according to the official's report. This was Tat Tong Zaunding, an official with Indonesia's search and rescue agency, stated that one of those seven bodies was wearing a life jacket. Now, I'm going to tell you, the ability to find a life jacket on an airplane, and most, for the most part, you know, that's the seat bottom is your flotation device. There are life jackets under a number of seats, but you've got to get them out of the bag. You've got to figure out how to put them on, and then you have to figure out how to inflate them. But with an airplane that is has a catastrophic failure of some sort that would cause it to disappear without the pilots so much as saying, "Houston, we have a problem," there is no chance that could be done. So it's an extraordinarily odd occurrence. But the fact that the other passengers still are clothed tells you that the airplane was intact when it slammed into the ocean. Now, what that typically means is that there was no catastrophic failure. That in the past, Airbuses have been susceptible in severe turbulence and in proximity to thunderstorms to having the tail rip off. It's happened 3 times to Airbuses, and it's primarily because they use a less expensive material to comprise the primary bolt that locks the tail section into the fuselage, where Boeing pays the Chinese more money for better material. Now, in this particular case, that does not appear to be the problem if the airplane hit the water intact. Now, if that is the case, what it means is that the pilot stalled the airplane. Is it at that a certainty? No, but it's likely. I mean, we already have pilots pulling a dunderhead move. Now, I am an ATP, airline transport pilot. It's the highest certification you can hold. I've owned my own jets, flown, been certified, type ready to fly my own jets. It does not make me the world's greatest pilot, don't claim to be. But I can tell you that as a pilot, if you are flying an aircraft and you have reason to believe either through the weather uplink, through the satellite, or through the radar on your aircraft, that you are approaching a thunderstorm, you ask controllers for the opportunity to veer left or right. You'll say, announce your aircraft tail number, and it is so essential that you not fly through the thunderstorm, you can actually say that you are going to fly 20 degrees left or right, of course. Now, typically, as pilots, we request it, request deviation left, of course, to avoid weather. But you're responsible for that airplane as a pilot, not the controller on the ground, and you are obligated to fly that airplane in a safe manner. So that's what you do. You veer left and right, of course. The reason you do that is at altitude, and this plane was at over 30,000 feet at the time. At altitude, the business part of a thunderstorm, while widespread on the ground, is very narrow atop. You've seen probably in the distance the anvil top of a thunderstorm. They narrow as they go up in altitude. So while an airplane, the difference between 30,000 feet, 33,000 feet, and 36,000, 37,000 feet is typically immaterial for the most severe aspect of a thunderstorm, the head at the top of the thunderstorm, a course variation of 10 degrees right or left is usually more than sufficient to avoid it, particularly at altitude. So this guy requested a climb of 4,000 feet for weather, which was denied. You know, you're climbing through various altitudes that are heavily packed with other aircraft. It's extremely dangerous. Where a variation, right or left, of course, when everybody's flying airways, is extremely safe. So we have pilots not knowing their business, improperly trained in this regard. And based upon one passenger having the time to put on a life jacket, means that the airplane was not spinning out of control and having the ability to do so, and having the first seven bodies all be clothed, as opposed to having, you know, their bodies ripped apart and clothes ripped apart and clothes ripped off, indicates that the airplane was stalled. So this appears to be pilot error, as was the case with the aircraft that was destroyed flying the Airbus too near a thunderstorm crossing the Atlantic off the coast of Brazil. My advice remains the same. Don't fly in an airplane that is piloted by and maintained by an Islamic nation. That's just the bottom line here. It's not safe. Turning to the next story, the SRN spokesperson said that significant tensions perpetrated and promoted by Sunni religious extremists are at play in Yemen. Well, if mass murder is an indication of significant tension, then okay, then maybe I need to elevate my definition of tension. And if this is a problem of Sunni religious extremists, then perhaps the announcer would be kind enough to point me in the direction of the moderate Islamic prophet. I would like to have a copy so that I can study it of the moderate Quran, of the moderate Hadith, of the moderate Muhammad. If there is such a thing as a moderate Islam as opposed to extreme Islam, I'm fully familiar with the extreme Islam that promotes 99.9% of terrorist acts in the world today, including 100% of suicide bombings. I found that in the Quran. I found that in the Hadith. I found that in the one and only Muhammad. So I'm familiar with the Islam of the jihadists. But I'm not familiar with any source material that would form the basis of moderate Islam. So perhaps one of these announcers, one of these politicians that's promoting the myth of moderate Islam and contrasting it to Islamic extremists might share the source material that is the basis of moderate Islam. Anyway, it's return to Yemen. A suicide bomber is something that Islam now has a complete monopoly on. That was the basis of the 9/11 suicide bombings of America's buildings in Yemen, when the southern city of Ibb killed at least 33 people. Who knows how many more they mutilated. The blast targeted a cultural center. When it says cultural center, let's read it correctly, a religious center, where members of the Houthi rebel group were gathered for a religious celebration. The Houthis are Shiite Muslims, and they were bombed, most likely, by Sunni Muslims. This is part of the world war that is emerging now between Sunni and Shia Muslims. This is a war that America not only started, but America is aiding and abetting, actually arming and fueling both sides. This war began when America invaded Iraq and changed the balance of power between Sunni and Shia Islam. And now it is a world war between Sunnis and Shias. This is all just one manifestation of that war. Now, there are countries where there are virtually no Shia Muslims. You know, Saudi Arabia, for example, is less than 5%. And they just have had no rights ever, and they have no hope of ever having any rights. But in countries where there is a significant minority of Shias, the Sunnis are at war against them, and the Shias are responding in kind. And in countries where there is a significant Shia population, they're trying to eradicate the Sunni population. That's what happened in Iraq after we invaded. We removed a Sunni dictator, replaced him with a government run out of Shiite Iran, and the Shiites began to oppress and exterminate the Sunnis. The Sunnis then responded by forming the Islamic State. We caused this problem. As we complete this review of what occurred in Yemen, the governor of the Ib province was among those mutilated by the blast, and it says that the Houthis, a Shia Muslim group, overran Yemen's capital of Sana'a earlier this year and have extended their influence over these past few months. It's a civil war between two religious groups, both Islamic. There isn't really an iota's worth of difference between a Sunni and Shia Muslim, by the way. This fight is simply for caliphate. This fight is simply for control. The difference between the Sunni and Shia Islam is absolutely insignificant. There are ayatollahs in Shia Islam, and there are mullahs and sheikhs in Sunni Islam. A Sunni fundamentalist is called a salaf. And Shia Islam, they celebrate Ashura Day, which is a pagan festival of the associated with Ashura, the moon goddess of Assyria. And they celebrate the death of Muhammad's grandson, the last hereditary link to Muhammad, who was killed by Abu Bakr's inspired Quraysh Muslims, who represent Sunni Islam. It was a battle then for control of the Islamic crime syndicate. It remains the same today. There is not a religious difference. There's a power difference. And it is a war that will be fought to the death. Ultimately, Sunni Islam will prevail. Dateline, New York. The United Nations, that's hardly united, Security Council rejected a resolution demanding an end to what is not even in quotes, Israeli occupation of the, and again not in quotes, Palestinian territories within 3 years. There is no Israeli occupation. I mean, if you consider occupation a people occupying other people's land, which is the implication, by force, then there is no occupation. If we want to describe the Israelis living and settling in Judea and Samaria, in Israel, as taking land belonging to others, then there really isn't much on earth that wouldn't be occupied. All of America. Everything in America. In fact, America's claim to this nation is infinitely worse than Israel's claim to Israel. Israel occupied Israel going back to 1400 BCE. You know, the first settlement within Israel goes back to 2000 BCE, 4,000 years ago. And at 1400 BCE, they settled there as a nation. Their history there is indisputable. Very long period of time. And it's one of the longest surviving ethnic groups in the world. With absolutely the best documented ancient history. Absolutely, unequivocally, Israel is the homeland of Israelis. There is no rational or logical way to dispute that. The proof is absolutely undeniable. They were a highly literate society. Hebrew was the first alphabet. They wrote their histories. They etched their histories in stone, and they interacted with every power known to man. They interacted with the Egyptians who wrote of them. They interacted with the Babylonians who wrote of them. They interacted with the Assyrians who wrote of them. They interacted with the Hittites who wrote of them. They interacted with the Phoenicians who wrote of them. They interacted with the Greeks who wrote of them. They interacted with the Romans who wrote of them. The only ones that they interacted with that did write of them were the Philistines, because they couldn't write. So the Israelis have absolute right to Israel. Unequivocal, undeniable. You have to be a complete moron to see it otherwise. As for the United States, the indigenous people have every right to America. The Sioux, the Apache, the Comanche, the Blackhawks, the Seminoles. They're the rightful owners of America. They have the right to occupy America. It is their land. The Hawaiians. America came in belligerent, ruthless, the Europeans did, and savaged the local population. And then that wasn't enough. They even stole land from Mexico and from Spain and from Britain, from France, and bought land from Russia that it didn't own. We have absolutely no valid claim to any part of America if you're an American. And Israel has the most valid claim to Israel of any race and ethnic group, any nation in human history. That's the first part. So Israeli occupation is moronic. It is absolutely, completely inconsistent with history. Palestinian territories are also inconsistent with history. And this is a point that I make all the time. I don't know if it's resonating with anyone, but this is how simple it is. Since the Philistines, of whom the Palestinians are named after, were illiterate, since they built no monuments, since there's not a single trace of them, there is nothing known of them other than what is found in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, other than what is found in Yahweh's testimony. There is nothing known of them. If Yahweh's testimony, therefore, is reliable, they're gone. They were wiped out by the Babylonians, and they have absolutely no rights, and there is no existent people group called Palestinians, nor any place called Palestine. It's long gone. And if that testimony of Yahweh and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is invalid, then there never were such a people, never was such a place. Unknown in any other way. So every bit of this should have been in quotes. There is no such thing as the United Nations. The nations are not united. In fact, the world has never been more dangerous. A lot of this is a combination of two things. One is the stupidity of George W. Bush, followed by the deceitfulness of Barack Hussein Obama. George W. Bush, based on a pile of lies, invaded Afghanistan and Iraq and made two bad situations much worse, and actually ignited the Sunni-Shia civil war that is engulfing the world. And it is the first blows of what will be World War III. That's a fire that will never be put out, and it's going to rage ever more violently. The Obaminator then gave speeches inspiring Islamic uprisings, and fundamentalist Muslims, Salafs, have risen to control and are taking over country after country. And we're beginning to see countries governed by Islamic jihadists. That was really stupid. The United States has become the arms merchant of the world and is supplying the Muslim nations with ungodly amounts of weapons. That's really stupid. In addition to that, America is reigniting the Cold War with Russia and has pushed Russia into a very difficult position. And I was always wondering, how in the world do we get back to a divide between Russia and the United States and between the United States and China that would create the conditions necessary for the nuclear holocaust that is described during the tribulation, when we appeared to be moving in the other direction? Well, Obama has single-handedly, as a president, reignited those conflicts. The world has never been more divided.
We are the largest terrorist organization. But think about that. They're willing to give guns to all these people around the world who aren't good people, but yet here in the country, they want to take guns away from law-abiding citizens.
That is correct. Isn't that weird? How we're providing the most powerful, most sophisticated, most deadly weapons of, weapons of mass destruction to our enemies, to the most ruthless regimes in human history, by the hundreds of billions. And in the United States, they want to take handguns away from law-abiding citizens.
Or if you have a 15-round clip, hey.
Yeah, we'll sell you an Apache attack helicopter with 10,000 rounds of 50-caliber ammunition and a Gatling gun that you, as a Muslim government, can deploy on Sunnis or Shias of your choosing. But if an American owns a clip for a gun that holds more than 10 rounds, even semi-automatic, no way. Can't have that.
Well, you might kill someone.
Forget about the U.S. Constitution that prohibits any interference with the ownership and carrying of weapons that would be used by a militia.
We are everything that we claim to be against.
That is correct.
We are 100% everything that we claim to be against.
They have a word that describes that.
Oh, hypocrite.
There you go. Hypocrite. Yep. So the next hypocritical term there is Security Council. There is no security being provided by the Security Council. None. And matter of fact, the countries that are the permanent seats on it are all very much infighting among themselves. China, Russia, the United States, for example. Anyway, they rejected and by the narrowest of votes, a resolution demanding an end to the Israeli occupation. There is no such thing as an Israeli occupation of Israel. That's their home. And there is no such thing with a Palestinian nor a Palestinian territory within 3 years. Jordan was the one that submitted the motion. There is a fair amount of prophecy speaking of the fate of Jordan. And while it does not appear that Jordan participates significantly in the Magog War, this upcoming World War III, where Muslims en masse flood into Israel after Israel is compelled to give up the West Bank, that Jordanians don't provide a meaningful force against Israel, but Jordanians are trampled underfoot by the marauding Muslims en route to Israel. And so there is the appearance of what I would suspect, looking at the world today, that the Islamic State ultimately does invade Jordan and prevail. Because Jordan, as a independent country, I think is going to cease to exist by this period of time. And when you lead a resolution on behalf of a religion as opposed to Yahweh and his chosen people and his promised land as this, I can tell you have no future. You know, you can do a lot of things in the world, and God doesn't really care. Now, he's disappointed. You know, and when the United States and Russia decided they would spar over the Ukraine and 3,000 or 4,000 people are killed as a result, yeah, it's disappointing. But it doesn't affect Israel and Israelis. When you do something that affects Israel and Israelis, God cares. He takes note. That's the promise, that he will bless those that bless thee and curse those that curse thee. So when you engage in a hostile act against Israel and Israelis, Yahweh cares. He pays attention. There is a consequence. And Jordan, it's going to happen to you. So Jordan submitted the motion, which had been agreed by 22, this says Arab states. There's no such thing really as an Arab state. They're Islamic states. You know, the Persia, for example, Iran, most of Iraq is Persian. And they would have agreed with this, but they're not Arab. And Arabs, Egypt is not Arab. Libya is not Arab. Morocco is not Arab. Tunisia is not Arab. Well, Arab is a very small numbers of people are actually Arab. This is 22 Islamic states. 8 members of the 15-member Security Council voted for it, while the United States and Australia were votes against it. So 8 members, and we're going to chronicle who those are, voted in favor of it. They pushed their ticket to their own demise. Again, you can do a lot of hideous things, and God's not pleased, but he's going to let you do it without immediate consequence. You threaten Israel. You pick on his chosen people, and there is a consequence. And it's egregious. And it's appropriate. The resolution condemned by Israel as a gimmick needed the support of at least 9 members in order to pass. It got 8 votes. Even if it had secured the required 9 votes, the U.S. would have used its veto power to stop the adoption of the resolution. It is assumed, but not known for sure. Of the 15 members of the Security Council, here are the nations that voted in favor of destroying Israel. And this is, make no mistake, this means I want Israel gone. I hate Jews. I hate the promised land. I want these people annihilated. That's what this means. If Israel, when Israel is forced out of Judea and Samaria, known as the West Bank by many, within a year of that time, we will witness over 100 million Muslims flooding into Israel at a rate faster than bullets and bombs can stop them. We will witness World War III and its inception within 6 months to a year of the time that this occurs, and everyone knows it. There isn't anyone in a position of power who doesn't realize that if this occurs, there won't be peace, there will be war. We played this game with Neville Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler regarding the high ground of Czechoslovakia. This is a far bigger issue, because Muslims, by their religion, are ordered to hunt down and kill Jews. And they will continue to do so. And they will issue promises of peace that they will treat as the ninth surah of the Quran orders them to do, completely ignoring the agreement and simply making Israel more vulnerable. Israel will be between 5 and 10 miles wide, where 70% of the population live, with a independent nation of Muslims who will then amass all of the weapons necessary to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And they will do so. They won't prevail, but they will attempt to do so. And so the following nations voted to eradicate the Jewish population of Israel. 6.5 to 7 million Jews, and to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Russia, China, France, Argentina, Chad, Chile, Jordan, and Luxembourg. Death. destruction, devastation await those countries. Death, destruction, and devastation await Russia, China, France, Chad, Chile, Jordan, and Luxembourg. Two nations voted in favor against the only two of the 15, the United States and Australia. The United Kingdom is a nation without character, a nation without a backbone, a nation that is adrift and wholly amoral. They abstained. Lithuania abstained. Nigeria abstained. Korea abstained. And so did Rwanda. No character. No class. No backbone. No morality. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering This. A news story just appeared on CBS News indicating that the whispers in Indonesia confirms what I had suspected, that the pilots stalled the aircraft, that the AirAsian flight crashed because the pilots attempted a climb even when vectoring right or left was the better course of action. They attempted to climb. They pulled the nose of the aircraft up steeply. The airspeed deteriorated. It takes a lot of airspeed at that altitude to maintain aerodynamic lift. They stalled the aircraft, and they did not recover from the stall, which is also not something that is particularly difficult to do. So the pilot's error is what killed those people. Returning to the story of the UN, you might wonder why the United States voted against the annihilation of Israel. Now, in the past, the United States obviously would do so, but, you know, you have Barack Hussein Obama at the helm of America now. And the answer really is because the Obamanator is a weasel. Anything he can do against Jews, for Muslims, arming the Muslims, making the Jews more vulnerable, behind the scenes as a weasel, he does. But in your face, the United States voting against Israel, he'd be run out of town, and he's just not going to be that forthright. So that's the reason why the United States voted against the resolution as opposed to for it. And to vote against the resolution, Obama took out his pound of flesh, you can be sure, in terms of what he did behind the scenes to against Israel. Hello, Larry. It's a sad day when you see countries like Russia, China, France, Argentina, Chile, for example, voting in favor of the annihilation of the chosen people and the promised land.
Well, you know, if we're to believe Yahweh's words, in the end, the entire world is attacking Jerusalem, right?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah. So, and if we're to believe Yahweh's testimony, any nation that works against, that moves against, that harms Israel and Israelis is going to face a bitter consequence. So, you know, thus far, everything he said I've found to be true. I wouldn't doubt him on this one for a nanosecond.
Well, you know, I like the way you point out that, you know, Obama is just a weasel. And that,
yes,
that's exactly how he operates. You know, the one thing that the United States can proudly hold up is that they hold no political actor to their word. None of them.
Correct.
Not ever.
None of them. No. You know, as a matter of fact, in this particular case, this demanded a comprehensive peace deal to be worked out within a year and Israel to withdraw from all occupied Palestinian territories within 2 years. Can you imagine negotiating a treaty with people whose charters, the PLO and Hamas on both sides of them, call for their complete eradication, the annihilation of the people and country is what their charters call for, and you're supposed to work out a peace treaty with countries that whose core documents, whose constitution demand your complete annihilation. How do you do that?
That's a rhetorical question, right?
Well, evidently not, because the world is pushing for Israel to capitulate. I mean, that is like you saying to a man holding a gun that, you know, what I would really like is for you to kill me. And I know that you're really good at killing, so would you please kill me?
Yeah.
I mean, can I load the gun for you? Can I let me walk right up and let me put my head on the end of the barrel?
You know, this is nothing new, you know, to you or I. I mean, you know, you mm-hmm. saw that in the Roadmap for Peace program. You wrote about it, you know,
right.
years and years ago.
Years ago. Yeah.
What's stunning is the people who are clearly, you know, bamboozled by all this.
Bamboozled by the myth that there is a Palestinian people. Bamboozled by the myth that there's a place called Palestine, that they're Palestinian territories. Bamboozled by the myth that the PLO and Hamas will let Israel exist in peace as a two-state solution the moment they're given total autonomy. I mean, the myth that you can trade land for peace. The myth that the Muslims will honor a treaty that they make with non-Muslims. The myth that that there is reciprocity, that this is an Israeli Arab conflict, and that both sides are at fault. I mean, come on, you're living the dream world.